Disclaimer: this episode of Dead Souls may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
February 14th, 1945. Lower Quinton, a quiet, sleepy village tucked away in the shadows of Warwickshire's Meon Hill. Whilst the rest of the world looked towards the final chapters of a devastating world war, a different kind of darkness was brewing deep within the English countryside. A 74-year-old local man named Charles Walton walked out into the biting winter air with his hedging tools. He wouldn't return. When they found his lifeless corpse, his death scene was so brutal, so meticulously ritualistic, it sent shockwaves through wartime Britain and put the knowledge and skills of Scotland Yard to their limits. But more than that, the murder ignited whispers of an ancient forbidden folklore that the locals had spent centuries trying to bury. The ritualistic murder of Charles Walton is a case where old superstitions meet modern detection, where the landscape itself seemed to guard a terrible secret, and where the silence of a village became the killer's greatest weapon. But who, or what, really killed Charles Walton? Pull up a chair, dim the lights, and step with me into the thick, dark fog. You're listening to Dead Souls. Tonight, I'm going to discuss a British crime that remains unsolved and an active cold case to this very day, despite being more than 80 years since it occurred. It's a moment in English history that is barely remembered or even spoke about anymore. This is a true crime incident, to be sure, but it's also something of an occult mystery, a real enigma. So let's dig into things. When St. Valentine's Day draws near, for many their thoughts will turn to love and romance. A corporate holiday manufactured by the card companies, perhaps. Or feelings of a courtly love or amorous desire influenced by a 3rd century Roman priest who defied Emperor Claudius II's ban on marriages by secretly wedding young couples. The same will be true in the quiet Warwickshire villages of Upper and Lower Quinton, two small villages just a single mile apart. But in these villages, February the 14th also stirs darker memories and reminds the older residents of past deeds, which they would rather forget. It was in the vicinity of these two villages that one of the strangest murders in British history took place. A crime whose brutality shocked the nation at the time, and which remains, as I said, unsolved to this very day. It is now 81 years since the events, which have since become known, at least in the local area, as the Witchcraft Murder. Quinton is a civil parish in the Stratford-on-Avon district of Warwickshire in England. It is the quintessential small English historic village. Small cottages with thatched roofs, old stone churches, a local farm shop, and town post office. It's located deep in the heart of the English countryside, just 13 miles south of Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare country, to my friends from overseas. It's also 57 miles south of Birmingham and 107 miles northwest of London, so far from bustling cities and more frantic walks of life. In 1945, the town had an extremely close-knit population of just 493 people. For context, there was actually twice this many people in my high school. The village was sleepy, relatively isolated, and largely retained its medieval character at the time, before undergoing significant modernisation in the post-war years. This all sounds very Victorian chocolate box so far, and that's not so far from the truth. But talking of the post-war years and the war in general, Allied victory in the Second World War by early 1945 seemed a dead certainty. Much of the Nazi-occupied territory in Europe had been liberated. Hitler's forces had been forced back and all but obliterated. And the Soviets had revealed the horrors at Auschwitz to the wider world. The end of the war was within reach within Europe, although its effects would still be felt in almost every aspect of British life for some time yet. Whilst rural areas in the UK hadn't endured the same destruction as parts of London from the Blitz, they were far from immune. Coventry was devastated by a bombing raid in 1940, as was Birmingham and parts of Manchester. Londoners, particularly children, had been evacuated into the rural Cotswolds, to Wales, Devon, and the Lake District to escape the Luftwaffe bombs. The Cotswolds area in south-east England, known for its natural beauty, rolling hills and picturesque natural views, was also a major hub for Allied troops. Hosting the so-called Ghost Army of our friends from the United States and Canada in the lead-up to the D-Day invasion of Europe. In addition to the significant build-up of armed forces, there was also a dozen prisoner of war camps scattered across the area. Across Warwickshire County in particular, so in the vicinity of Quinton Village. Finding themselves in a limbo between the patriotic push to repel the Nazis and an uncertain post-war future, many rural British folk began looking backwards to the roots that had historically bound them to their lands. What do I mean by this exactly? Well, many revisited folklore and traditional ways that dredged up superstitions, and they leaned into older customs to reconnect with a way of life that had been forgotten amid bombing raids and a collective national focus to defeat the German aggressors. This element of tonight's story will become more important later. Now, if Charles Walton had been killed in any other time or place, his death would likely have been forgotten. And it almost has been. But because he was slain on a Warwickshire hillside in February of 1945, in the midst of this strange in-between time, his unsolved murder has become an enduring mystery. That, of course, and the bizarre intertwining of witchcraft and Sherlock Holmes-esque high strangeness during the final throes of a world war. Charles Walton was a mostly unremarkable man. He'd lived in Lower Quinton, Warwickshire, his entire life. He purchased a cottage opposite the village church during the period of the First World War and became a widower when his wife died in 1927. Shortly after, he adopted his three-year-old niece, Edith Walton, following the death of her mother. By 1945, the pair were still living together in the same cottage in Quinton. However, Edith was now a working-age woman, having found a job as a printer's assembler at the Royal Society of Arts, which had relocated to Lower Quinton in 1943. Charles was by now 74 years old and stiff with rheumatism. He was generally well-liked throughout the village, but was quiet and mostly kept to himself. He had been a farm labourer for his entire life, and was particularly skilled at training horses. Even though Charles received an old age pension, he continued to work part-time for Alfred Potter, a local farm owner. On the morning of Wednesday, February the 14th, 1945, Charles set off from his cottage with a pitchfork and a slash hook, or brush hook, in addition to his usual walking stick. Charles was headed for a field known as Hillground on the Potter's farm property, where he was tasked with cutting hedges on the slopes of Meon Hill that day. Charles routinely stopped working for lunch at around 11 a.m, then finished his workday and returned home at 4. But on that day, when Edith returned to the cottage at around 6 p.m, she was surprised to discover that her uncle wasn't there. Charles did not spend any time at the village pub, and as he kept to himself, he didn't pay any social visits. So with that in mind, Edith knew right away that something was out of the ordinary. She went right to a neighbour's house, a neighbour named Harry Beasley, and the pair set out for the farm to look for Charles. Alfred Potter told them that he had last seen Charles slashing hedges on Meon Hill, and the three set out towards the base of the hill, hoping to find Charles still there. Edith was worried that her uncle had fallen ill or was injured and unable to make his way home. But what she discovered was actually far, far worse. Her uncle, Charles Walton, had been brutally murdered, butchered, massacred on the land that he worked. The scene was so gruesome that Edith's scream could be heard far and afield in all directions. Charles had been beaten over the head with his own walking stick. His slash hook was deeply embedded within his neck, almost severing his head entirely, and his body was pinned to the ground by the prongs of his own pitchfork. According to observers of the horrific scene, a large crucifix had been carved into his chest. A passing local was instructed to fetch the police immediately, whilst Potter remained at the scene to stand guard while Beasley took Edith away from the gruesome discovery. A local police officer named Michael Lamanzi was the first to arrive at the scene at 7:05 p.m. Investigators from Stratford-upon-Avon were summoned, along with the director of the West Midlands Forensic Crime Laboratory. After photographing the scene and collecting evidence, Walton's body was removed in the early morning hours of February the 15th. Later that same day, the Deputy Chief Constable of Warwickshire Police sent a message requesting assistance from London's Scotland Yard. The request stated that the murder was either committed by a, quote, madman, or one of the Italian prisoners from a nearby prisoner of war camp. The police constable was referring to Long Marsden, a large prisoner of war camp around 2.5 miles, or 4 kilometres, from Lower Quinton. It's unclear what made the POW camp an immediate area of suspicion, or why the suspect was specifically believed to be Italian, as Germans were also housed there. There may have been legitimately underlying reasons for this, or simply time period prejudices at play. Nonetheless, a detective fluent in Italian was dispatched by Stratford police to interview prisoners at the camp. The bilingual officer quickly learned that POWs were essentially free to leave the camp at certain times of the day, and that on the day of the murder, some men from the camp had actually gone to Stratford to see a play, while others had gone to the cinema. The POW camp offered no further clues, and investigators turned to what they considered the next most likely scenario. That being Charles Walton had been murdered by a madman. Given the sensational nature of the crime, Scotland Yard sent its best-known detective, Chief Inspector Robert Fabian, and his partner Sergeant Albert Webb. Fabian was considered so skilled at detective work that he was often referred to as the real-life Sherlock Holmes. Fun fact, Fabian's career would later be dramatised in a BBC television series titled Fabian of the Yard. And there's no denying that his time on the police force was downright cinematic. Fabian had captured London's first known cat burglar after identifying his silent rubber-soled evening dress shoes, and had disarmed an IRA bomb in Piccadilly with his bare hands with just seconds remaining on the timer. But now, Warwickshire police were hopeful that Fabian could find Charles Walton's killer. Now, there were a few clues to work from. A post-mortem had found that Walton's death had been caused by the slash hook, which had sliced through his trachea. Charles also had bruising on his chest and a number of broken ribs, along with defensive wounds on his hands and forearms. Authorities determined that he had likely died between 1 and 2 p.m. Further, he had left his wallet at home that day, and the only item missing from his body was a second-hand pocket watch, making robbery an unlikely motive for his killing. A massive search was conducted, and hundreds of locals were interviewed. It was determined that Charles had been seen crossing the churchyard on his way to work between 9 and 9:30 that morning. He was seen after that time only by the farm owner, Alfred Potter. P.C. Lamazny had noticed that when he arrived at the crime scene, Potter had seemed more worried than one would have expected him to be. They say that everyone reacts differently when faced with death, and if there is a set expectation for worry after finding your employee speared through his chest with a pitchfork, I've not heard of it. Answers in an email, honestly. Lamazny noted that Potter had left before the Stratford police had arrived, complaining of feeling cold, which the police officer considered a strange excuse from someone who was used to attending to animals at all hours and in all kinds of weather. But again, what does this really indicate? It's a whole hill of nothing thus far. Potter had passed the police as they arrived and gave a brief statement about his relationship with the victim and his discovery of the body. More compelling than his perceived behaviour at the crime scene, however, was Potter's continually changing narrative. On February the 17th, Potter was interviewed by Detective Sergeant Webb. He explained that he had known Charles Walton for more than 5 years and had employed the man as a casual labourer for the past 9 months. Potter paid Charles 18 pence an hour, and he was allowed to keep track of his own hours worked and report them to Potter for payment. There was a great deal of trust in this arrangement. But Potter implied that Charles may have been collecting wages for more hours than he actually worked, although he did not explicitly accuse the elderly man of deceiving him. He usually paid Charles every fortnight, and had last paid him £2.15 on February the 10th for the work completing in the 2 weeks prior to that date. Potter said that on the day of the murder he had left the College Arms pub with another local farmer at around noon. After leaving the establishment, Potter walked across a field to check on some sheep and fed some of his calves. He had seen Charles working in his shirt sleeves on the slope of Meon Hill at around 12:20 p.m. He said he would usually have checked in with his employee, but he was eager to attend a cow that was stuck in a ditch. Potter had thus gone home, arriving at around 12:40 p.m. Then he had left again at once to rescue his heifer. There was a problem with Potter's story, though. Fabian discovered that his cow had drowned in a ditch on February the 13th. Not only was there no need for Potter to hurry to help the creature, but the animal wasn't removed until 3:30 p.m. on the day of the murder, nearly 3 hours after Potter claimed to have attended to it. Fabian instructed P.C. Lamazny, who knew Potter and his wife well, to stick close to the couple in case they accidentally revealed anything else. On February 20th, Lamazny told the Potters that the police were hopeful that they might be able to collect fingerprints from the slash hook and pitchfork to assist in identifying the killer. Alfred Potter quickly told the officer that he had touched the handle of the slash hook and possibly the pitchfork too, because Harry Beasley had urged him to have a look to make sure that he was dead when they found the body. Potter said that he was sure that he'd already told the police this, but Mrs. Potter was upset and said they were sure to think Alfred was the killer if his plinth were on the murder weapon. Soon after, a soldier called at the house and Mr. Potter told Lamazny he'd come to tell him the military police at the POW camp had arrested an Italian prisoner. The officer recorded that Potter affected great glee and his wife became almost hysterical with delight at the news. The prisoner had been found crouching in a ditch on Meon Hill with bloody hands, but he was soon released after he explained that he was a poacher who supplemented his meagre camp rations with rabbits. When Potter was questioned again on February the 23rd, he changed his account of February the 14th yet again. He said that after checking his animals, he had come home, read the newspaper for about 5 minutes, then gone out to help a farm worker, a man by the name of Charles Batchelor. He was busy pulping some marigolds. He continued stating that when they were finished, the two men had looked up at the church clock and seen that it was 1 p.m. Mrs. Potter corroborated her husband's story, stating that he had arrived home shortly after 12:30 p.m, opened the paper to read, inquired how long dinner would be, then went back out to help Batchelor, returning at roughly 1:05 p.m. Batchelor also confirmed that Potter had helped him with the marigolds at around 12:40 that day. Still, in his report, Fabian wrote that Potter was undoubtedly lying about his actions at the critical time. The detective also found that there was no report of Potter telling the local constables that he touched a hook or pitchfork, and Harry Beasley denied ever asking him to check the body. There was no need, as Charles was so clearly dead. In his interviews with police, Potter had expressed certainty that he'd seen Charles working between 12 and 12:20, but he later testified at the inquiry that he'd seen someone standing stationary in the field at 12:30, but could not be absolutely certain that it was Charles Walton. Potter's inconsistencies were enough to raise Fabian's suspicions, and he requested an inquiry into Potter's finances to look for any outstanding debts. But Potter's books appeared clean, and in fact there was some evidence to suggest that he had been claiming more money than necessary to pay Charles Walton's wages from his family's farming company, likely pocketing the difference. Though Fabian maintained suspicions of Potter's involvement, he was forced to admit that he'd found no real evidence to connect him with the murder, and no reasonable motive could be found. Fabian did discover an anomaly with Charles Walton's bank account, though. The man had inherited nearly £300 from his wife, which he placed in a building society. But when he died, his account balance was just £2.11. Now, Charles lived a very frugal lifestyle, with his weekly expenditures being estimated at under £2. He received a pension and worked, so there was no reason he would have to withdraw such a large amount from his savings. Fabian was unable to determine what had become of Charles's money, or if its absence had any link to his death. Having exhausted all his usual tactics, Fabian considered more far-flung leads, including a possible connection to a murder committed in Long Compton 70 years prior. On September the 15th, 1875, 80-year-old Anne Tennant walked to buy a loaf of bread at around 8 o'clock in the evening. She passed by a group of local farmers. The group included James Haywood, a simple-minded man her family had known for many years. Entirely unprovoked, Haywood had attacked Anne with a pitchfork, stabbing her in the legs and head. She died from her injuries later that night. The man claimed that he had killed Anne because she was a witch and had put a hex on him. Haywood was found not guilty on the grounds of insanity and was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in an asylum for the criminally insane. While it was not possible that James Haywood had killed Charles Walton, as he had died in 1890, the similarities in the two murders were striking. Both Anne and Charles were elderly and defenseless. They had both been killed in a bold, unprovoked attack involving a pitchfork, and both murders occurred just 20 kilometres, or 12 miles apart. The close locations of the murders was shocking, especially as murder was an extremely rare crime in this place, and during this time period, let alone two so similar. Warwickshire Detective Superintendent Alex Spooner pointed Fabian to a 1929 book titled, quote, Folklore, Old Customs and Superstitions in Shakespeareland, by the Reverend James Harvey Bloom. The book was a collection of local customs, folk rhymes, rites, and superstitions, and it included a story about a young ploughboy named Charles Walton, who, during 9 successive nights in 1885, encountered a mysterious black dog while walking home. On the final occasion, the dog was in the company of a headless woman. When Walton arrived home, the ploughboy received news that his sister had died. Detective Spooner believed that it was possible that the murder victim was the same Charles Walton who saw the ominous black dog, and that Walton's isolated life within the small rural village was because of his early brush with the occult. This led to rumours that Charles Walton was a witch himself. Indeed, locals reported that Charles Walton was known to breed natterjack toads in his cottage garden, and that he could control even the wildest of dogs with only a quiet whisper. He could be seen feeding flocks of birds straight from the palm of his outstretched hands, and one farmer said that he had witnessed Walton hitching a toad to a plough to curse a field of crops. Some locals speculated that it was Charles Walton who was responsible for the death of Potter's cow on February the 13th, and that he was to blame for the poor crop harvest of 1944. Detective Spooner believed it was possible that Charles' killer was not a wandering maniac, but a local who believed that the old man was a witch and needed to be cast out. You see, after murdering Ann Tennant, James Haywood had claimed that the only way to ensure a witch didn't rise up again was to pin them to the earth. Had whoever killed Charles Walton believed Haywood's ravings? Charles Walton's final resting place also has ties to the supernatural. Local legend has it that Meon Hill was created by the devil himself as he watched the construction of Evesham Abbey. The devil grew angry at the progress and kicked a clod of earth towards the abbey to bury it. But Christian prayers stopped the mound of dirt before it could reach its target, bringing it to rest at Quinton. The site was also home to an Iron Age hill fort, and there is evidence of a prehistoric camp dating back to the Neolithic period. Because of its ancient significance, Meon Hill is rife with legends of buried treasure, a hidden gateway to the Celtic underworld, and of ghostly wanderers. In one such legend, a huntsman took his men out on the Sabbath, and the hill opened up beneath them, swallowing them whole for their godlessness. Their ghosts are said to haunt the hill around midnight, on Sundays, to this very day. There are also, of course, tales of mysterious black dogs, the wolf pack of a spectral Celtic king. Famed archaeologist Margaret Murray hypothesized that Charles Walton's murder was carried out as a ritual sacrifice by a group of locals still practicing a pagan religion. Murray pointed out that Walton had died on Valentine's Day, which she claimed was a remnant of Enoch, a Celtic midwinter celebration centered on ensuring a successful harvest. Murray believed that Walton's final resting place was located upon an ancient burial site. Additionally, his manner of death pointed to satanic ritual sacrifice. His head was slashed nearly clean off of his body, and he was pinned to the ground so that copious amounts of blood could soak into the earth. Detective Fabian didn't put too much stock in the theories of witchcraft, ritual, and superstition, but he did note a decidedly chilly reception from locals during his investigation. Fabian and Webb interviewed nearly 500 villagers, but none had much to say. One man told Fabian, quote, "Walton was dead and buried, so there was nothing more to worry about." While it was not unusual for a small community to be wary of a hotshot detective from the capital, their silence seemed almost planned, as if they had all agreed to maintain silence. Fabian even interviewed teenagers and children as young as 11 from the area, but established no new leads. Fabian commented on how distant and foggy the children seemed to be when responding to his questions, like they were brainwashed. On March the 20th, the inquest returned a verdict of murder against a person or persons unknown. Defeated, Fabian prepared to return to London. Before he left Lower Quinton, however, the detective took a final walk to the site of the murder, which he later described in his memoirs as a bleak and lonely place. As he took into view, a large black dog ran past him, emerging from out of nowhere. A few moments later, a young boy walked up the hill, and Fabian asked him if he had lost his dog. The boy seemed confused, so Fabian explained about the black hound that had raced past him a few minutes earlier. The boy's face drained of colour, and he turned and ran from Fabian. Shortly after Fabian had left Lower Quinton, a large black dog was found hanging by its neck from a tree at the murder site. Charles Walton's murder eventually faded from public interest. Warwickshire was overtaken by celebrations as VE Day made the end of the war in Europe official, and attention was turned to the business of tidying up the Nazis' mess. But Detective Spooner could not forget about the unsolved murder and continued to return to Lower Quinton, convinced that a local man was responsible for the crime and would eventually reveal himself. But despite his efforts to gain the villagers' trust, he was never warmly welcomed. Still, Spooner continued to return to Meon Hill every February the 14th for the next 19 years, dying shortly after his final trip to the murder site. In 1960, the outhouse behind Charles Walton's cottage was demolished. During the demolition, a worker spotted something glinting in the rubble. It was Charles Walton's pocket watch. Inside the case, there was a small piece of coloured glass. It was rumoured that Walton was never without his watch, or this strange piece of glass. Locals believed it to be witch glass, used to reflect or absorb any evil thoughts directed at its owner. The police had devoted much time to locating the missing item, including a thorough search of the cottage and the outhouse. Had Charles Walton's killer placed the watch there sometime after the investigation? Or had it been returned home by some other force? The investigation into the crime is still technically open. Over the years, there has been renewed interest in revisiting the case. Back in 2014, BBC Coventry sent a reporter to Lower Quinton to cover the lasting impact of the murder. The reporter found the same tight-lipped response from locals that Fabian experienced some 80 years earlier. The landlord of the College Arms pub, Tony Smith, said plainly, quote, "I can't talk to you about that. After 17 years of running this place, I know there are some things that we just don't talk about here." A shopkeeper, who refused to give her name, told the BBC reporter, quote, "The people don't speak about it. It's a closed subject." The gentleman who ran the post office in the village said simply, quote, "No one will talk to you about it here. The family have all gone now anyway. There are none of the Walton family left here, and I have no answers for any of your questions." Many people believe that Fabian's initial instincts were correct and that Alfred Potter was the murderer. It's theorized that Potter had borrowed a large sum of money from Charles Walton in order to pay off gambling debts, perhaps explaining the disappearance of Walton's savings. Then, unable or unwilling to pay his employee back, Potter had seized upon finding him alone in a hedgerow with a murder weapon at hand. At the time his investigation concluded, Fabian was still certain that Potter was the most likely culprit. In fact, after the detectives returned to London, local constables who had stood guard over the crime scene on the night of the murder told Fabian that Potter had returned to Meon Hill just after first light on February the 15th. Potter had commented on the cold weather, shared a cigarette with one of the officers, and then left. Fabian and Webb actually returned to Lower Quinton to interview Potter once again about this new information, but they were unable to move the case forward. Still, it appears that Fabian's certainty about the nature of the crime waned in the following years. 25 years after the investigation, the renowned former detective Fabian penned a warning stating, quote, "I advise anyone who is tempted at any time to venture into black magic, witchcraft, shamanism, call it what you will, to remember Charles Walton and to think of his death, which was clearly the ghastly climax of a pagan rite." Dead Souls is researched, written, produced and hosted by me, Jamie Black, with music by Mark Butler and Coag. Dead Souls is not part of any network or corporation and is entirely independent. Therefore, our views are completely free from any bias or censorship. For more information about our show, follow us on Twitter at Dead Soulscast and Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. For $2 a month, you will get access to exclusive ad-free episodes only for Patreon supporters, and exclusive access to written articles, blogs, and research. You may have noticed that sometimes our podcast doesn't appear on your YouTube feed, and very often, our podcasts get age-restricted or removed altogether. This isn't by accident. We cover topics that are not always algorithm-friendly, and the big corporations don't love it when we talk about certain topics or have certain conversations, especially the kind that challenge mainstream narratives. This is another reason we have created our Patreon. It is a space where we can post full, unfiltered and uncensored topics that the big platforms and mainstream media don't always like. Proceeds from our Patreon go directly to supporting us, our show, our research, and keeping the lights on here at Dead Souls HQ. Go check it out. Patreon.com/Dead Souls. That's it. Thank you for listening. Good night, everyone.